The Secrets of Middle-Earth is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give.
You're listening to The Secrets of Middle-Earth, where we discuss the hidden themes and deeper layers found in the works of J.R.R. Tolkien, whether in his writings or in any of the media derived from them, or in this case, some Tolkien-adjacent content. I'm Jeff Hecker, and joining me today on the panel are Alex Murray. Hey, Alex.
Hey, Jeff. How you doing?
Doing well. And Thomas Salerno. Hey, Thomas.
Hello there, Jeff.
All right. Be sure to follow The Secrets of Middle-Earth in Apple Podcasts, YouTube Music, Spotify, or any podcast directory or app. And you can find us on social media at facebook.com/StarQuestMedia or on X or Twitter, where we are at SQPN, or on Instagram, where we are at StarQuest Network. And don't forget, you can get your own official Secrets of Middle-Earth merch, including our awesome t-shirt, at sqpn.com/merch. It's a great way for you to support the show and show your love for Tolkien and his wonderful world of Middle-Earth. And as I alluded to, today we are actually going to take a little bit of a step outside of Middle-Earth, you know, maybe keeping one foot in, one foot out, and talking about the friendship and influence of J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. So talking about their friendship and their influence on one another. And just up front, I want to say we're not necessarily going into a, you know, we're not providing a biography of them or anything like that. There are a lot of books and other resources out there. And I think the kind of the one of more popular books, which I haven't read, I don't know if either of you have, is Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, The Gift of Friendship by Colin Duryea's. I don't know if either of you have read or know anything about that book.
I haven't read it, but I did just listen to his book, The Inklings, on Audible. So that's how familiar I am with, with his writings. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. How about you, Thomas? Have you read or know anything about it?
I recognize the title. I have not read it yet. No. Okay. I did read once this other book. It wasn't the same, but there are several books just called The Inklings. This one was like a door stopper. I didn't even get through it. And I can't.
It must not have been his. It must have been. Because there are a couple of books with the title of The Inklings.
Yeah, exactly.
How does that happen? But anyway. Yeah.
Well, since we've kind of talked about Tolkien's background before, I thought we should start with a little bit of background on C.S. Lewis. So for just as an intro, so he grew up in Ireland and moved to England as a boy. And after college, he also served in World War I. So that's one connection to Tolkien right there, is they both served in the war and were profoundly affected by it. And
if I remember right, Lewis was an Ulsterman. Right. So he was from Northern Ireland specifically.
Yeah.
Not from the Irish Republic. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Ulster meaning the Protestant part of Ireland at the time.
Yeah.
And I guess still now. Not an expert on Irish history or politics either. So forgive me if I misspoke.
Nobody is.
That's true.
All right. But they eventually ended up at Oxford, and they first met at a faculty meeting. And funnily enough, they disagreed on a curriculum for the students on what was important for them. But they became friends, and Lewis joined a discussion group of Tolkien's, and eventually they were both part of the group famously called the Inklings. So that is a term that includes other authors and kind of a reading club or book club where they would present their own works and discuss amongst each other at a pub. I believe the Eagle and the Child, is that right?
The Eagle and Child, yeah.
The Eagle and Child.
Or the Bird and Baby.
And then before we kind of go into more, just one kind of funny anecdote, I think this is from the biography of C.S. Lewis by Alistair McGrath, but I found it in a different article, which we'll provide some of these links for your own perusal. But there was, in 1939, Lewis made the dangerous nighttime journey to his friend's house during a wartime blackout to drink gin and lime juice and discuss Tolkien's new Hobbit book. So just kind of a funny anecdote I saw. So they were obviously pretty good friends if you're going to brave a blackout and, come over with the necessities. And it's just, kind of sets up the kind of friendship. But one thing that, that was interesting to me is, when I was kind of researching this, is Lewis convinced Tolkien not to just focus on the languages, but encouraged to write the story of Lord of the Rings, because surprising no one, Tolkien was just obsessed with the languages and just wanted to invent and write them, and didn't really have a, you know, because the languages kind of started at first for Middle Earth before he then built the story around, but it was Lewis who kind of convinced him. And then I think Thomas, you put in a quote here if you want to read it.
Right. Yeah. Tolkien had basically said, and I'm sorry, I can't reference which exact letter this is from, but if you go to the Tolkien's collected letters, and I think if you look up Lewis in the index, you should be able to find this. But Tolkien wrote that it was Lewis who helped him finish The Lord of the Rings through encouragement. He said, quote, "The unpayable debt that I owe him, Lewis, was not influence, as it is ordinarily understood, but sheer encouragement. He was for long my only audience. Only from him did I ever get the idea that my stuff could be more than a private hobby. But for his interest and unceasing eagerness for more, I should never have brought The Lord of the Rings to a conclusion."
And for that, we are forever in debt to C.S. Lewis.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jack, as he was called. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Tallers and Jack is what they called one another.
I know. I wish I had named my dogs Tallers and Jack.
Yeah. I have to think of that the next time I get cats. I'll have to
exactly. You know, one of the things that I kind of probably spent way too much time trying to find unsuccessfully. And I even brought in my fellow late Dominicans down in Oxford. Can you help me find this? Without success is, now Tolkien and Lewis didn't like the syllabus for the English literature. And I can't remember if it's medieval. Well, no, it wouldn't have been medieval English literature at Oxford.
Probably so they middle didn't English. Like,
well, I think it was just the syllabus that had been set up in whichever college the English department was in. And so they went about creating their own syllabus, which was predominantly medieval. And so things for the students to read. And I thought, oh my gosh, I would love to get my hands on that syllabus. And it was used at Oxford for like 20 years. And for that, and at the time, it was very controversial because everybody wanted like the critical historical approach to literature, which is pretty much now, I think, universal in a lot of universities, unfortunately. But their curriculum held sway for 20 years. And I wanted to, my goal was to try to find the syllabus so we could go through and see how much of it we've never read before.
Oh, that sounds
all
cool.
Of it.
And then like go back and try to read it. Well, I couldn't find it anywhere. And I then, like I said, I brought in a couple of different lay Dominicans to help me. They really couldn't find it, but I suspect it might be at the Bodleian. So the next time I go down, I'll go down like an hour or two before I need to be at my meeting, and I will just go into the Bodleian and see if I can, if they have a copy of that syllabus. And if they do, I shall post it on the Discord page for Middle Earth.
Oh, that's cool. I suspect the only thing I've ever read that could possibly be on it would be like Sir Gawain and the Green Knight.
Yeah.
Or maybe Beowulf.
Beowulf.
Well, yeah, and I was thinking the Canterbury Tales or the Song of Roland, maybe.
Oh, Song of Roland. Yeah.
Yeah.
I read that in high school.
I know. It's so cool. But so we'll have to see. I'll have to see if I can find it. But everyone was like, maybe it's, you know, I would go to so many different links and follow. And then suddenly it would be like, you need to have, you know, your Oxford email account in order to access
paywall. Great.
No. Yeah, so we'll see if I can do some puppy dog eyes at the Bodleian. maybe they'll take pity on me and just let me see it. But like I said, wouldn't that be just the most amazing thing for a reading list?
Oh yeah, that'd be amazing. And like college reading lists back then were much more thorough and, you know, heavy than they are now.
Yeah, you're expected to start reading before you got there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and just as you, our listeners may be aware, is their writing style was very different. So they, off the bat, they are very different people. They're not, you know, they're similar, but also very different. It's almost kind of a Gimli Legolas type of situation.
Yeah, I mean, that's true, because Dr. Holly Ordway, who has recently written a biography of Tolkien called Tolkien's Faith, she kind of references that in, because she has a whole chapter on Tolkien and Lewis's friendship. And at the beginning of it, she writes that, quote, "The two men are sometimes blurred together as a sort of a composite Oxonian fantasy writer. But they were very different personalities, and it was a complex friendship, one that was deep-rooted and enduring, despite many differences between them professionally, temperamentally, and spiritually."
Yeah.
So it's not like they didn't have their differences or things, you know, but I find that often makes good friends when you're not exactly the same, when you have, you know, vast differences that complement one another.
Well, what would be the point in being friends with somebody if you're both the same? You might as well just hang out by yourself. I don't know. that's my way of thinking. But speaking of friendship, I was thinking about this as I was pondering. I can remember I read out loud the Chronicles of Narnia to my children, and I read out loud every year Lord of the Rings. And I was thinking, why didn't I never reread? I mean, I did reread the Chronicles of Narnia, and then my children kind of read it to themselves. But it was just a different, there was just something different, mm-hmm. where I connected with Tolkien much more. And I was thinking about their friendship. And one of the things that I think C.S. Lewis really articulated so well was what friendship was. And that was based on his reading and studying of the Aristotelian understanding of friendship. So it's the mutual love of a third thing, two people loving something else. And I suppose we could even reference that to the Trinity. That makes sense. Oh, but also, you know, he wrote so beautifully about friendship and, kind of on an intellectual level, which is wonderful. But, and I think this is what helped Tolkien in some of the writing of Lord of the Rings. Lewis's sort of definition and understanding and study of friendship. And then Tolkien lived that friendship through Middle Earth. Like it was a lived, you know, you got to see, I'm going to just say it in like a reality of Middle Earth, what Lewis was talking about on an academic level. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah. I mean, like, friendship has got to be one of the key takeaways from reading Lord of the Rings, you know? And whoops.
Yeah. Yeah.
Am I back?
Yeah.
I think? Oh, okay.
Yeah, you are.
My internet cut out for a second.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I just, I find especially, of course, the friendship between Frodo and Sam in Lord of the Rings and how far they went. But then when you look at C.S. Lewis's life and how he saw friendship, there's an example in The Inklings. It might have been in Ordway's book as well. I don't know. But during World War I, when Lewis was fighting, a lot of his friends obviously were killed, just like everybody else. You know, everyone knew someone who'd been killed in the war. But one of his friends, when he died, he left his widowed mother and sister, and they didn't have anybody to help them out. And of course, back then, you didn't have any kind of real support system from the state or whatever. And so Lewis promised his friend on his friend's deathbed that he would look after his friend's mother and sister. And he did, to his own, I mean, financial sacrifice. It was not easy because the mother was quite ill. that's an incredible friend, you know? And he was doing that when he met, that was part of who he was when he met Tolkien. And I just wonder if that's sort of the way Lewis lived out his understanding of friendship influenced Tolkien and how he wrote the relationship between Frodo and Sam. Mm. You know, Sam looking after Frodo when they got back to the Shire and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and that's one of the most beautiful parts of the whole trilogy, that end where, like, Frodo says something like, no hobbit in the Shire was looked after with so much care.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I just wonder if that was what he saw with, and then of course, Lewis, when he married Joy, is it Davies?
Davidman Gresham.
Davidman, yeah. I mean, that was kind of a beautiful tragedy, that whole relationship.
Mm-hmm. Which yeah. I can get into more later because Tolkien had his own thoughts about it.
He did. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have to ask you guys before we get deeper in, when did either of you come to Lewis before Tolkien? Because I definitely did. I must have read the Chronicles of Narnia when I was in like fourth grade or something. And that would have been before I had discovered Tolkien.
I think for me, I was always kind of aware of Narnia, that it was out there, but I don't think I ever, maybe I heard it in school a little bit or something. But I don't think I read it until the first movie was coming out. So similar to the Lord of the Rings movies, I didn't read Lord of the Rings until the movies were close to coming out. I had familiarity with The Hobbit though, but not with Lord of the Rings before the movies. But so I think it was similar for Narnia. I can't remember if I read the book before I saw the first movie, but after that I read the books and I've read them at least a couple times since, but that was when I was in, maybe I was in college. Cause I want to say the first movie came out when I was in college for Narnia. So I may not have read them till college actually, but I was always kind of aware, but yeah, I knew of Tolkien first for me.
Yeah. I knew of Tolkien first. So I had, you know, read The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, and obviously saw the old Japanese cartoon of The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings first. But I remember I was in a conversation with a woman. I was working at a ministry in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I was telling her about my disastrous attempts of making Turkish delight. And she's like, it was like really bad. It was over here. So I was visiting here trying to help my toddler niece make something. And why we decided on Turkish delight, I don't know, but something went wrong and it was a disaster. And I tried to give a piece, like it was so bad. The dog, which was a lab, you know, they eat anything.
Oh yeah. My neighbor's is a lab. He eats rocks and sticks and stuff.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. So this dog tried to eat it, could not eat it, and started barking at it. So it was a real, it was a really bad.
Good thing you could never use it to tempt somebody to betray Narnia. Like,
exactly. Yeah, there was no temptation.
Yeah, no, my wife's an English language arts teacher, and one of the things they teach in. She teaches in a Catholic school is about Narnia. Like I think they cover Lion, Witch in the Wardrobe. And one of the things they do is after they read the book, I think they watch the movie. And so we've had to buy Turkish delight off Amazon just as like part of it. And I think we end up with a lot of leftovers, which we don't ever touch. Cause
oh my gosh, I love Turkish delight.
I haven't ever had what they got, but I don't know that her kids have really enjoyed it in the past, but
it is an odd flavor because it's like rose water, which is kind of a weird flavor.
Huh.
But
that's interesting.
Yeah. But so I was telling this woman that about this disaster. Of course, oh my gosh, everyone just took the mick out of me here. It was like, you know, this young American bride coming over and totally screwing up some, you know, staid British little snack. But anyway, and she told me, she's like, oh, that's like Edmund in the Chronicles of Narnia. And so from that, that's what actually inspired me to sit down and actually read the Chronicles of Narnia was my disastrous attempt at Turkish delight.
That's okay. Fun. Yeah. do any of you have a favorite Narnia book?
I do.
Which is it?
The Horse and His Boy.
Really?
Yes.
That's actually a really fun book. I think it's underrated.
I love that because one of the things that was the one that was like the most I could get into the universe. You know, mm-hmm. The other ones, it was just like, I don't know why. I mean, I love animals. And so the idea of animals talking and stuff, I always appealed to me. But for some reason, he must have had a good knowledge of horses because, you know, I like when he's talking about Mr. and Mrs. Beaver, I'm like, beavers don't act like that. I used to work for a wildlife clinic and we looked after beavers and they don't act like that. But and I don't know enough about badgers because they kind of scare me. But horses, the way he described, I can't remember the name of the horse now.
Oh, anyway. I just remember its really long name was like Winnie, Bernie, something or other.
Yeah. But the way the horses acted, I'm like, that's how horses act, you know? And I love the part when the two horses were like rolling before they got back to Narnia, you know, where they escaped from their slavery at this one, I feel so bad. I'm so embarrassed. I can't remember all the names of these things, but when they escaped and they were going back, I guess the male horse decided he was going to roll around and the female horse was like, maybe, you know, talking horses don't roll like that. And he's like, oh my gosh. Oh no. But the fact that he was having such a good time rolling around in the dirt and the dust. I mean, anybody who's ever seen horses love to do that, especially right after you've groomed them and they look beautiful. It's like, oh, now I can roll around in the mud.
I think my favorite, or at least the one that I return to the most often, is The Magician's Nephew.
That one was scary to me.
It is scary, but the creation of Narnia sequence is beautiful.
It's very much like the Silmarillion, actually.
It is, yeah, because it's created out of music, and just the way he describes Aslan singing Narnia into existence is very beautiful. Also, there's a lot of great humor in it when you get to see the villain, Uncle Andrew, really get his comeuppance. The talking animals like do various awful things to him because they think they don't know he's like sapient and is like a rational being. They think he's like a dumb animal. At one point, they think he's a tree. They plant him in the ground and throw water on him.
Upside down.
My favorite part, though, is when they put him in a cage and they start throwing food at him, like literally pelting him with food to see if he'll eat. The bear drops a live honeycomb on his face. He gets attacked by bees and they eventually decide that the uncle's name is Brandy because that's the only word he says because he's an alcoholic. He's like, Brandy. God. And they're like, his name's Brandy. And I'm like, this is a lot. Like, I'm like, that would never fly today in a kid's book. And it's great. It's hilarious. But yeah, I like The Magician's Nephew because it starts in the real world and you slowly get like, you know, introduced to the origins of Narnia and where the White Witch comes from.
I know. But see, that's what creeped me out. Like somebody rang the bell and then the bell kept ringing. I mean, that's creepy.
And the deplorable word where you can say one word and it kills all life.
And
it has the wood between the worlds, which is really a cool concept where these different ponds lead you into the different. It's just so great. And there's a horse in that one too. Strawberry starts out as a normal horse, but then becomes a Pegasus when he gets to Narnia.
I mean, it's just, it is really interesting. And I can see how, I'm just trying, at times I'm trying to picture, you know, Tolkien, in terms of their personalities, I get the impression that Lewis was definitely the extrovert in the relationship.
Oh, yeah.
And Tolkien was more the introvert. And even Tolkien, in the Inklings, it says that he was kind of famous or infamous because he would just mumble his lectures, whereas C.S. Lewis had this great booming voice, and he had his series on the BBC, Mere Christianity. You know, he was just really out there. And I just imagine Tolkien being quite, you know, cerebral and really trying to take things in, and having Lewis read all of this chaotic stuff. What must Tolkien have been thinking? Like, and we're where to start.
And Tolkien took his most kid friendly book, The Hobbit, and he attempted to rewrite it as an adult book.
Yeah.
After The Lord of the Rings came out, like he only got three chapters in, but he tried to make The Hobbit match the tone of The Lord of the Rings because he's like, oh, The Hobbit is silly. It's not serious literature like The Lord of the Rings is. I'm going to update it. And people were like, no, JR, don't do this. And he's like,
no, Tollers.
Peter Jackson succeeded where Tolkien did not.
Did he really, though?
I know.
That's the free space on your bingo card. We have made fun of the Hobbit movies.
Oh my gosh. Well, to be fair, you know, when I first read The Hobbit, you know, I was like, this is clearly, you know, oin and gloin. And yeah, I was like, oh my goodness. But I can remember when Bard drew the bow of the Black Arrow. And to me, it was like, it suddenly flipped. It suddenly became a very different story. And it did. I think that's where it changed from a child's story into something else. And I think with the Chronicles of Narnia, it was more of a, in many ways, I think, and I wrote this down in my notes, I think Tolkien's world has always been much more realistic to me. Like Middle Earth is, you know, my kind of place. I would love, you know, versus the universe of Narnia. I'm going to just say, I think because of Tolkien's knowledge and foundation in medieval Catholicism and how he understood the medieval mind. And this story is written like a saga, one of the old sagas. And you can see how people would get into these stories like Beowulf or I can't think of another. Well, I guess there aren't any other medieval English sagas anymore because a lot of them were destroyed. But besides that, it just became real in this world, whereas The Chronicles of Narnia is kind of like a little bit of a commentary on this world. Like, I'm just thinking about, is it the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, when Eustace comes in and the way he describes the school and how the teachers are interested in the bullies and they don't actually discipline the bullies. They study the bullies and, you know, and they just eventually grow up to be bullies.
Mm-hmm.
All of that is a commentary on what he was seeing happening in academia at the time.
Right. Huh. Like what he wrote in the Abolition of Man
about
what was going on in school. That book though has a great beginning, right? Because that's the one where it says like there was a boy named Eustace Scrub and he almost deserved it.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh,
that's great. It's a great one.
On speaking of that, I think that one might be my favorite. It might be tied with Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, but I just like that one because you're traveling to all these different islands and and you have Reepa Cheep, who's I think he was in Prince Caspian if I remember correctly.
Yeah, he was.
And he's kind of like going out. He wants to go on this adventure to see the end of the world, and they do get there too. And he goes to Aslan's country, but he's like, Aslan says, you know, you can come, but you can't go back.
Like Valinor.
Familiar. Yeah, I was going to say, sounds very familiar.
But yeah, definitely their writing style. I mean, obviously Lewis is I'll see if I can find, I think Alex, you might've sent it or one of us shared it to our internal stuff, but it was it was about how Tolkien, or how Lewis, just everything's an allegory, and yeah. I mean Aslan is Jesus, and
yeah,
very obviously, whereas Tolkien was very non-allegorical, and he very clearly said Lord of the Rings is not an allegory of, you know, Aragorn is not Jesus. There's similarities, of course, you know, obviously, yeah. Return of the King and such. But
like Sauron is not, despite all the letters he got from people telling him that Sauron is Stalin, he's like, no, he's not.
Yeah. Do you want to know something? This is interesting that you're saying, because I didn't realize that until just now. Years ago, we went to Poland for the first time. My youngest child decided that's where she wanted to go for her birthday, and her birthday's in January. So we went to Poland in January, which is super cold. But we did like a historical tour of Warsaw. And on the tour, there's this massive tower, like in the middle of the city. And that was put up by Stalin, and they called it, oh, this is Stalin's gift. And it's like a big, horrible tower where where they would just kind of, the guards would just watch the city.
Maybe so, that's why, because like I read in Ordway's book that when Tolkien helped a Polish academic come to England during the early part of the Cold War, and like this was the 50s, the Lord of the Rings was out already, but he met like his Polish colleague at the airport, and the Polish man greets Tolkien with, I come from Mordor.
Yeah. Because
it was the Iron Curtain, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I think totally. This just shows the timelessness of Tolkien. Like, because I mean, there's always going to be evil, and there's probably always going to be some kind of great evil, whether it's a country or, you know, an ideology or something. There's always going to be something that's that's worth fighting, you know, to fighting against.
That's necessary to fight against. Yeah. You have to. Yeah. You know.
Yeah. But,
And speaking of like evil, in terms of like, you know, both of their stories are about fighting against cosmic evil, you know, which is even in Lewis's space trilogy, which was really influenced by Tolkien, because Lewis's protagonist in his space trilogy, Elwyn Ransom, is kind of a pastiche of Tolkien.
Yeah.
They both like going on walking tours together. And in the beginning of Out of the Silent Planet, Ransom is going on a walking tour around England. Ransom is a philologist. So is Tolkien. Like,
yeah. But then, of course, Treebeard was a nod to C.S. Lewis and his great booming voice. Yeah, exactly. And whenever he's described, like the way Durrez described him in The Inklings, was he was a man of, I guess, medium height, which I don't know what that means. It's like when somebody goes, oh, there are hogs the size of dogs. I'm like, that tells me nothing. That tells me nothing. So man of medium height, but he had a farmer's build. Which I think is so funny, because a farmer's build is, that's a look in this country. Do you know? Oh. It really is. It's not an athletic build. Let me just put it that way. But it's like kind of encompassed in lots of tweed and corduroy, which is lovely, you know, and you can't be, you know, it's just, you can pull it off. You have to be a certain kind of person to pull it off, and clearly C.S. Lewis is one of those guys, but he must have had like a big barrel chest. That's what I think of. And just this big booming voice. And that's what, that's who Treebeard was based upon.
And it's funny too, that those books, the space trilogy, came out of their science fiction writing contest that they set one another as part of the Inklings. Tolkien never finished.
That's true. But some argue that, Lord of the Rings was actually a time travel science fiction.
It kind of is, because like it, well, especially because both the Lost Road and the Notion Club papers, which were his two attempts to write this time travel book, because Tolkien was going to write time travel, Lewis was going to write space travel. But when Tolkien, in both times, he ties the time travel into the Numenor stuff.
Yeah.
into the legendarium. So it would have actually been time travel back from present day to Middle Earth. So
yeah, that's how you do it. Yeah.
And it's funny that that second attempt to write the novel, The Notion Club, was a play on the Inklings. Because when you have an inkling, you have a notion.
Yeah.
So because it's about this writers group called the Notion Club, and they discover time travel. And
oh god, yeah, exactly. And they go all the way back to Numenor.
Numenor, and which Lewis even mentions. When I read That Hideous Strength, the third space trilogy book, for the first time, I was shocked to find a reference to Numenor in the beginning of it. In the preface, Lewis writes, "Those who would like to know further about Numenor and the True West must, alas, wait the publication of much that exists only in the manuscripts of my friend, Professor J.R.R. Tolkien."
So cool. Wouldn't you just love to have just been there in that environment that allowed these men to really thrive intellectually, creatively? You know, it's something that the Inklings was a creation of C.S. Lewis. And he brought in all of these different really interesting people, and probably people that I don't know if Tolkien always seems to be a very charitable man, but not necessarily going out of his way to meet people from various, you know, he was in this book. Juraz says that Tolkien was the oldest of the Inklings. They had a lot of reverence for him, but he didn't kind of put himself out there. It was Lewis who would like make connections with people. And that's what I mean. Like he was much more of an extrovert, and he would, and there's this one part where Lewis, there was one of the Inklings was a little bit, I don't know, they were all Christian, and Lewis's brother was also part of the Inklings when he could be, but he was in the military, so he would come and go. But
oh, is that Warren?
Yeah, yeah. Warney.
Warney.
And yeah. Warney Tollers. I know. He talks about one of the Inklings. He was kind of, I wish I could remember his name. I think his first name was Charles, and that's all I can remember. When he Charles, this man, had a very different notion of God and Christianity, and I think he even believed in reincarnation.
Oh, so Charles always, Williams.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Tolkien was friends with him as well, but he like agreed with nothing of what this man said.
Yeah.
And he would just, so when he died, Lewis said he remembers the three of them talking together a lot. But when Charles died, he said, "I didn't have more of Tolkien. I had less because I couldn't see." Part of the friendship was seeing how Tolkien would react to whatever Charles was saying, you know? And so they really felt that loss of their own friendship when this other person wasn't there, who was like, just not really, someone that Tolkien agreed with on any level at all.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, but that shows that, you know, both these men were capable of like true friendship. You know, like when I was in college, yes, I was friends with all kinds of people. You know, one of my friends like told me quite plainly when we first started being friends, he's like, "I'm a Marxist." And I'm like, okay. I'm like, but that didn't stop us from being friends. You know, like I had a friend who I bonded with Tolkien over who was a neo-pagan. We didn't agree on anything religious, you know?
Yeah. Well, my standard for friendship has always been, how you treat your dog, how you treat your spouse, and how you treat your children. Like if we can agree on that, cause I have met people, we're politically, we might be on the same page. Religiously, we might be on the same page, but you know, if you're like mean to a cat, I'm sorry. I'm having a hard time. just can't, you know, it's yeah. So I think it's easy to, and I do, you know, you don't want to live in an echo chamber. Like I said, right. You know, just stay by myself. If that's
and
what
as
I wanted
Tolkien
to do.
And Lewis grew older too, I think naturally they just kind of started to see less of one another because you're old, you don't get around as much, you know, like.
And also Lewis was not well. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Tolkien outlived Lewis by almost 10 years, didn't he?
I think, yeah, about a decade. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Tolkien didn't like to drive.
Neither one of them did.
Oh, Lewis didn't like to drive either.
No.
Oh, that's funny. And what is it with literary giants? Literary giants don't like to drive. Like one of my favorites, Ray Bradbury, never got a driver's license. Hated driving.
Yeah.
And I'm like...
I think it's just, well, I was going to say, like, I hate driving in Oxford, but that's another story.
Even though Tolkien did commandeer a bus when he was a student.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, my gosh. That's
a prank. Yeah.
So funny. That is too funny.
Yeah, and no. Tolkien once said, too, that when they started to see one another less, he had this joke where he would tell people that a minor imp of Slubgob's brood especially attends to prevent CSL and I from meeting. And that's, of course, a reference to the character Slubgob from the Screwtape Letters, which Lewis actually dedicated to Tolkien. That's I think the only book of his that's dedicated to Tolkien is the Screwtape Letters.
That's
and I
so
have a
cool.
fond, I have a fondness for the Screwtape Letters because we did a stage adaptation in high school and I was Screwtape.
Oh, okay. So you would have loved that. Oh my gosh.
Do any pictures exist of this?
I was gonna say.
I have photos. Maybe I should put them on the Discord.
You should. You absolutely should.
And my algebra teacher was my assistant, Toadpipe. So I got to
these names.
I worst. Got to bully my algebra teacher as Screwtape.
Every high schooler's dream.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Well, yeah, I have something. Sorry. Go ahead, Jeff.
Oh, and I was saying, yeah. And I mean, just to touch on C.S. Lewis's writings. I've read the Screwtape Letters and I've read Mere Christianity, I believe. Mm-hmm.
And those are good.
Yeah, those are great. So, yeah, definitely. And I mean, I haven't read as much of Tolkien's letters and other things. I've primarily read The Legendarium, but you know, y'all could speak more too if Tolkien really gets more into spirituality type stuff. And I don't know that he probably doesn't, just because C.S. Lewis, as we've kind of discussed, is much more allegorical and has no problem writing an allegory or a story,
right.
You know, whether it's Narnia or Screwtape Letters or Mere Christianity involving.
Tolkien really didn't believe in lay people doing that kind of public evangelization. That was kind of his thing. In fact, he would butt heads with Lewis over it because Lewis was always on the radio doing evangelization. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is what I was going to say. He had this larger audience. And I also wonder, and this is something that I've discovered moving to England. And I'm not saying this as a criticism, but the number of English Catholics of a particular generation, it was really drummed into them that you were lucky you got to be here. And so there really wasn't the only way of evangelizing was if maybe you married someone and they converted, but there was no, you know, they were kind of living with the aftermath of the brutality of what happened to Catholics in this country. And I don't know how much of that influenced Tolkien's approach.
I think he definitely did, because he says in his letters that he believes his mother essentially died from persecution.
Yeah.
Because her health was so poor and her Protestant family, he didn't feel, did enough for her.
They didn't do anything. Yeah. They cut her off, you know, with two small children, and she was a widow, and they cut her off from any support, financial support or any kind of support. And then when she died, the two boys were left, that nobody came to get them. So they were raised by the Oratorians. Thanks be to God.
Yeah.
We did a whole episode like a year and a half ago on Tolkien's faith. And we talked about his, how he was raised and him and his brother were raised by the Oratorians. So
yeah. 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 So it's really something that maybe his approach, because of course, Lewis, when he converted, he became an Anglican, which is the state religion. You can say whatever you want. You know, there's a little more freedom in that, you know, but to be a Catholic, was probably at that point still in Britain, not ideal, a little strange, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, Tolkien suspected throughout their whole friendship that Lewis had an undercurrent of kind of anti-Catholic bias just because of his upbringing as an Ulsterman. You know,
I would agree with him.
Tolkien said there's a great deal of Ulster still left in CSL, if hidden from himself. And Ulster, of course, being Protestant, predominantly Protestant Northern Ireland, where Lewis grew up. But, you know, they didn't allow Lewis even was sort of at least tacitly aware of these, you know, ingrained prejudices. And he didn't allow it to ruin his friendship with Tolkien. And, you know,
but he couldn't go all the way.
Right. He couldn't go all the way. And, you know, but that's why I said, like, it shows that, you know, there's. That kind of grassroots ecumenism, where it's like it's not official, you know, like just people of different faith traditions can become friends and influence one another, you know, like.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, and Tolkien had a mass said for him, which you can do. You know?
Yeah. After Lewis passed away, he had mass said. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was really, I think it was a, I get the impression it was a very intense relationship, not in a bad way, but like these two men who have, you know, they're just, you know, their intellectual capabilities were off the scale. You know, how many times in the world do you get these kinds of minds and then they come together? It's like a nuclear explosion, but, you know, a super collider or something like that. But I think they both loved truth and tried to pull out different aspects of truth in their writing. And I mean, I'm a little biased. I like the way Tolkien did it more. I like C.S. Lewis very much. And I like the way he said in the beginning of The Lion and the Witch and the Wardrobe, he started writing it, I think, for one of his nieces. And he said, "You're too young to appreciate fairy tales, you know." And so to go back, you know, maybe when you're older, you'll appreciate this more. And I do agree with that. You know, I feel like I'm ready to reread the Chronicles of Narnia.
Oh, I started rereading them recently. Yeah, I'm in a few chapters into. I'm doing them chronologically, meaning from the prequel all the way through. And I know some people hate that. They want you to read in publication order, but since I've read the whole thing already, I prefer how the publishers number them now. So I started with Magician's Nephew and I'm now making my way again through,
Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Reading it like that. I didn't like it.
Starting with the prequel.
I did. Yeah. I because I think we did it. I read it the first way. For public, you know, as they were published. And then I read it the other way and I just didn't like it. To me, it didn't flow. I don't know.
I think it's more ingrained in me because when I first read them, it was in an omnibus version. It was a giant, huge coffee table book version of the entire Chronicles.
I think that's what we had too.
Yeah. Wow. And it had all of Pauline Bain's illustrations.
Yeah.
By the way,
we will talk about. I want to talk about.
Oh, yeah. But I was just going to say that, like, it went from it started with The Magician's Nephew. So that's how I first read them.
Yeah.
So now I have a hard time reading them the other way because it's like, no, you always start with The Magician's Nephew. It's like, yeah.
But to me, that's it's like, oh, why don't we read Return of the King first? That doesn't make sense. That's not how it was written.
Well, I mean, to be fair, the Lord of the Rings is all, it's really all one one book
anyway.
It is. That's
just
true.
Separated out, you know, divided up. So. Now,
Alex, didn't Pauline Bain, she also illustrated some of Tolkien's stuff, right?
Yes, that's what I was going to mention. And every once in a while, I will post one of the finds that comes into the bookshop of Tolkien's books that was illustrated by Pauline Baines. She and Tolkien were lifelong friends, and he first met her when his publication of his little story, The Farmer Giles of Ham.
Oh, I love that.
Yes. So there was he wasn't really happy with the illustrations of, I guess, who I don't even know who it was, because they ended up not doing it. That the publisher had recommended. And then he just saw a couple of Pauline Bain's illustrations, and he's like, I really want her to do this. And so she did the illustrations for Farmer Giles, and Tolkien said that his text was merely a commentary on her illustrations. That's how much he loved it. And she was going to do all of the illustrations for Lord of the Rings, but then it just grew into this massive,
huge project.
Project. But she studied in detail medieval manuscripts and medieval art. And so that's the foundation of her illustrations. But what I think is ironic is she did all of the illustrations for the Chronicles of Narnia, because she was introduced to C.S. Lewis by Tolkien, and they only met twice. So she knew Tolkien for, you know, until he died, and only got to do a couple of his illustrations.
Wow.
She did all of Narnia and only met Lewis a couple of times. But what's interesting, she had a really interesting life. And I know hopefully you'll have her website in the show notes, but she married an ex World War I German who stayed in Britain after the war, and he was the local dog meats man. So he's the one who would sell because this is before dog kibbles, where they would eat raw meat and raw vegetables and everything. So he was the dog meats man, and you used to have the cat meats man who.
Oh, okay, good. When you said dog meats man, I'm thinking like, oh wait, they sell people dog meat? That's no good.
Not in this country. Oh my gosh. They would be like, there's no way people, I think you could sell people meat before you could sell dog meat in this country. But anyway, he was like, he was a gardener and he was the dog meets man. And he and Tolkien used to exchange war stories.
Really?
Yeah. So that is that's somebody that was in this, you know, it's because of Tolkien introducing Pauline Baines to C.S. Lewis, where we have all those fantastic illustrations. But
oh my gosh, I would have liked to have seen The Hobbit done in her.
Do you know what?
I know it's great that we have Tolkien's Hobbit illustrations in the illustrated version, but it's like, I almost would have liked to have seen a Pauline Baines take on The Hobbit. I feel like that would be perfect.
As opposed to, oh, help me with his name, Alan Lee,
or John Howe.
Yeah, exactly. But the thing is about those illustrations, they're not kind of medieval in their style. Whereas Pauline Baines was, and Lord of the Rings has such a medieval feel to it. I think it would have been, I don't know, maybe I'll get myself together and I was thinking about this, like, oh, I would love to do some illustrations of Lord of the Rings, but bring in some of the medieval manuscript, like the illuminations and flowers and symbolic things and different scenes. Yeah.
I like how and Lee's like realistic style, like realism, simply because I'm influenced in my childhood by James Gurney, the guy who did the Dinotopia books.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's that little, here I'm going to get into like sacred art. It's that little bit of abstract that makes you, that gives you a clue that you're going into a different world, a higher world. That's what I love about medieval artwork. But, and Pauline Baines did she was so prolific. She literally was drawing and painting up until she died in 2008.
She died that recently.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
1922 okay. to 2008.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Look on our website. It's beautiful and get lost in it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And yeah. I love biographies. If a book-length biography of her exists, I'll pick it up. But
I think, you know what, it'll be on her website. If there is, there'll be a link. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. She was a fascinating woman.
Yeah. And then I think as we're kind of getting to the end, unfortunately, of C.S. Lewis's life, Thomas, I think you put in here some notes about another kind of wedge between Tolkien and Lewis, of Lewis's marriage.
Right, because Lewis ended up marrying a correspondent of his. They corresponded by letter, and that was Joy Davidman Gresham, who was a divorced American with two children. And the union was kept secret initially, even from Lewis's friends. And Tolkien wrote to an acquaintance, "He never even told me. I learned of it long after the event." And so he was kind of hurt by that. And also, being a Catholic, Tolkien was concerned that the marriage might have been adulterous. But as it turned out later, Joy's previous marriage was to a divorced man. So from the Catholic point of view, her first marriage wouldn't have been valid anyway. But at this time, the Anglican tradition did not have annulments. And they didn't allow divorce, ironically.
How ironic is that?
Yeah. the Anglicans did not allow divorce, and they had no annulment system, whereas the Catholic Church did have possibility for annulments. Yeah. And if this was in a Catholic context, she would have been able to argue, well, my first quote-unquote marriage was to a man who had been divorced anyway, so that would have...
It was never valid.
It was never valid to begin with. And in fact, Lewis made this argument to his local Anglican bishop, who said no. But then Lewis found some Anglican priest who would marry them anyway.
As you do
in the 20th century. Yes.
Exactly. Oh, my goodness.
But you can see why, as a very devout Catholic, you know, Tolkien would be troubled by this. He as Holly Ordway put it, he was concerned for his friend's soul. Because, you know, he's like, adultery, you know, thou shalt not commit adultery is one of the Ten Commandments, a serious sin.
Yeah, it's like top 10.
Yeah, and he's literally the top 10. And like, he didn't want his friend to have incurred such spiritual danger, you know. So, and I think he was also hurt that he was kept a secret.
Yeah. What is it about these like American divorcees that come over here and just...
like what wrecked Edward VIII, right?
Was it Edward the Eighth? Yeah.
The king who...
Simpson.
Wallace Simpson. Mm-hmm. And then that's why you had George VI during World War II. The King's Speech. I love that movie, by the way.
Yeah. So
the King's Speech, if you want more on that.
Like I said, these Americans coming over and marrying these Brits and messing everything up. Present company excluded.
Or like, Churchill's mother was an American.
She was,
I remember when Churchill spoke before Congress, he said something to the effect of, if it had been the other way around, I might have gotten to Congress on my own.
because if you are an American and your child is born overseas, you have to get their you have to apply for their citizenship, right? Or are they automatically American?
If the child is American, or if the child has an American parent, I thought the child was, but I could be wrong.
I don't know, but I know. Interestingly, so by British law, my children were born in America, but they were automatically given British citizenship because it has to go back so many generations that one parent's family has to be British, born in Britain, and so as it worked out,
I guess they have to, at least from what I'm a quick Google, don't quote us on, because this is Secrets of Middle Earth, not secrets.
We're not giving legal immigration law,
but as a parent would have to apply for it, so I guess it's not an automatic.
That's what I thought.
But if you're born on U.S. soil, then I believe you're
okay. That's what it is. And in Britain, by British law, you just have to have one parent that has like two or three, I think it's like four generations back. And I think that I argue that's because they want to get some rugby players from like South Africa, New Zealand
or New Zealand.
Yeah.
I remember when I went to a high school, a Catholic high school, where The kids were obsessed with the All Blacks, the New Zealand rugby team.
No, I love the Springboks and
the South African team. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And then, but of course my husband is, it's always like a tense day in the house when Scotland versus England is on.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It's either going to be a good day or a bad day. Yeah.
Well,
UK, you get like four different soccer and rugby teams because of the different.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. We should do like a, I don't know, Middle Earth and rugby. Someday. I don't know.
Who would win in a rugby match?
Yeah.
Gondor or Rohan? Who would win?
Or the dwarves.
Oh my god.
Yeah,
gosh.
The dwarves, yeah. Well,
they would be really good in a scrum. Very, actually.
Very dangerous over short distances.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, as we're kind of getting close to the end here, unfortunately, you know, like we kind of alluded to, C.S. Lewis did die much younger than Tolkien, and he, I was kind of quickly reading about his health and had all kinds of problems, but he fell into a coma in 63 and he did recover within a couple days. He woke up, but I think, you know, pretty much he was never the same and had end stage kidney disease and suddenly passed away in November. So
passed away on the same day that John F. Kennedy was assassinated.
November
22nd, 1963.
11/22/63. That's right.
Yep.
And I think Thomas, you put in here that Tolkien said Lewis's death felt like an axe blow near the roots. Even if they were kind of had somewhat estrangement or, you know, at least weren't as close as they used to be, they still had that, you know, deep rooted friendship from their
last conversation days. Was something to about do trees have souls? Or something like that. And I'm like, of course they would talk about trees as like their final conversation.
Well, and then when you think about him being, you know, the influence of Treebeard being coming from C.S. Lewis and then this axe blown near the roots.
Mm.
Yeah, that kind of makes it all the more tragic. But I think the Inklings, you know, when you read about them, and I do recommend, you know, reading Colin Juris's book on the Inklings, it was almost like this amazing moment in time for all of them that would never happen again.
Yep.
You know, where all these different really creative minds come together right after World War II, living through, you know, they were all veterans of one war and kind of probably in shock that the second war happened because it wasn't supposed to. But I think that really, you know, it made them really think about things in such a concentrated way and in such a creative way. And when things started settling down in the West, it kind of faded away, you know?
Mm.
Yeah. And I think the last thing on here is, we're not going to play this, but there's I don't know if you watched this, Thomas, but there was a video about how Tolkien was unhappy with Narnia because of course, he was
because it was
unhappy.
Goofy.
Yeah, I believe that's from the YouTube channel Into the Wardrobe, which is a very good YouTube channel talking about mostly about C.S. Lewis, but also Tolkien on occasion. And he explains why exactly. You know, when Tolkien, when he read those opening chapters of Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, he was not happy at all. And told Lewis so.
Yeah. But it's, because the fawn, you know, he's like, does the fawn have a wife? Why are we even talking about this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lewis threw all kinds of mythologies together into a blender. And with Tolkien, that was just like, you can't do that.
Father Christmas and, you know, fawns and talking animals. And
it was like me,
Jesus.
Right. It'd be like me when I was younger and I would go see the newer Jurassic Park movies and I would be such a smart aleck because I knew everything about dinosaurs and being like, that's not accurate. You know, it's like nowadays I don't care as much about that, but
No, it's not like it's if the one place where you can get really uptight about things is in the Star Trek universe. Because it could actually happen. And why can't you get it right? You shouldn't. That's not how physics works. That's not.
Reverse the polarity.
Exactly.
That's Doctor Who.
Oh, is it?
Well, I'm sure they reverse the polarity in Star Trek, but that is the
thing. No, you know why? Because in that episode of Stargate where they do all the spoofs, Star Trek spoof, they say reverse the polarity.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But in Enterprise, that's how that's before they had shields. They just reversed the polarity.
The whole polarity. I remember that. See, now we're talking about completely different stuff, so we should probably wrap it up. I know.
It's like, we're just moving from one universe to the next. Tolkien would be really upset, but Lewis would love it.
Well, we're just jumping through the pools of the Narnia multiverse.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's the next multiverse Hollywood's going to do is the Narnia. The Narniaverse. They are doing a TV series, I believe it's going to be on Netflix.
Well, now they were saying it was a movie too. Like, they can't get their story straight. And sometimes they say it's a TV series. Sometimes they say it's a movie.
Let me do the quick Google.
And they can't finish anything. That's what was annoying me. Remember when the films came out, what, in the early 2000s?
No.
And I'm like, okay, so let's see the rest of them. And you never did.
And Netflix can't finish anything because they didn't finish the Dark Crystal prequels.
No.
And I'm like, come on, you can't leave.
I know.
So it looks like it might be filming in a couple. It might start filming in a couple of months. So it'll be a while before it's released. It looks like it might now be a film.
Yeah.
From what I'm seeing.
And it's got the same director as the Barbie movie, right?
Yeah. Greta Gerwig.
Oh, gosh. Sorry.
She's done other things.
Yeah, well, that's not good enough, Jeff. Sorry.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. Maybe that's something down the road when in
maybe it'll three, be a song years. And dance routine that
we can tackle in a couple of years whenever it eventually comes out. But well, before we conclude, did y'all have any other thoughts or anything else to say on the? I mean, we went through it very quickly and went all over the place. But there's, as we mentioned, I'll just mention the names again: Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, The Gift of Friendship by Colin Durez. There's plenty of other books out there, and Thomas, you mentioned Holly Ordway's The Faith of Tolkien, Tolkien's Faith. Definitely a lot. If you're interested more in their friendship, and in the letters and various things, there's a lot out there. So, but any other comments or anything else to say on the friendship between C.S. Lewis and J.R. Tolkien?
I'm just glad that it happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause we wouldn't be, without C.S. Lewis, we probably wouldn't be here talking about
Lord of the Rings. It would never have been finished. Yeah,
exactly.
Or it would have just been a very dry text on languages in the fantasy world.
Yeah.
All right. Well, with that being said, that is it for this episode of The Secrets of Middle Earth. We'd like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make this show possible, including Cindy M, Daniel C, Barrett H, Philip D, and James C. Their generous donations help us to continue to create The Secrets of Middle Earth and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them at sqpn.com/give. Now, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. What do you think about the friendship of C.S. Lewis and J.R. Tolkien and their influence on each other? You can let us know on our Facebook page or on Twitter, or by sending an email to middleearth@sqpn.com, or by leaving us a comment on YouTube, or by visiting our channel on the StarQuest Discord community at sqpn.com/discord. And I think we'll probably drop some pictures when this episode drops, so stay tuned for that as well.
Pictures of Thomas as
Screwtape. Yeah.
And I think Alex,
when this episode comes out, I'll put them in the Discord server.
Good.
Yeah, so
good.
Stay tuned. And I think, Alex, you have pictures of the actual pub as well.
Yes, I do. And also, whenever a really interesting old collector's item from Tolkien comes into the bookshop, I always try to post those on Discord as well.
Yeah, so definitely worth checking us out on Discord, and you know, we can ramble further on the multiverse of Narnia or other things there. So, but until then, join us next time for another discussion on the world of Middle Earth. And thank you, Thomas, for joining and sharing the secrets of Middle Earth.
Thank you, Jeff.
And Alex, thank you as well.
Thank you so much.
And until then, I'm Jeff Hecker. Thank you for listening to The Secrets of Middle Earth on StarQuest.
Here's another show on the StarQuest Network you're sure to enjoy, The Secrets of Star Trek. Find it wherever fine podcasts are found or at sqpn.com/StarTrek.